Yeah, but I've been talking to these folks.
Rules, the Committee on Revenue for June 1st, we are in the final month, will come to order, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3599. Colleagues, the point of this work session is to get this bill over to Ways and Means so they can handle it, and don't think we don't have a position on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3599 without recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 3599 to the floor without recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Yes. Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to put on the record the reason that we had sent this here, and I hope future education committees will do the same, is that education state school fund formula discussion appropriately takes place in the revenue committee. And this ends up being an expenditure, but the revenue committee is where the state school fund formula discussions reside.
Right. Thank you. And I do appreciate that comment about our jurisdiction. Sometimes people manage to forget that one, and I have to remind them constantly. Other discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? No objection to the motion. The motion carries. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3599 and open a public hearing.
3666.
Yes. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3666. Mazin.
Morning, Chief Von Hart, members of the committee. C-666 is a bill that we've heard before in a different format, or close to a different format. It was in House Bill 3333. Somebody manages those numbers. We'll
luck of the draw.
And it primarily is about the discussion and direction with the Oregon Investment Council on the investment with the companies doing business or having that that list developed with the companies that are doing business with the government of Iran. And I understand that we have the State Treasurer Office and Representative Venemer here to...
Widener.
Sorry, Widener. Pardon me, Representative.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24. Just here to update you where we're at. We were hoping to have all amendments and fiscals and everything done today, but as you know, trying to get to a zero fiscal and keep things nice and clean can be very difficult when we're dealing with a subject like this. We're pretty much down to just a couple small details that we have to work out, easily accessible information for determining what companies are invested in Iran and aren't. We're going off the federal government's website, and my staff has been looking into that quite heavily and working with the treasurer's office hand in hand to make sure we get this right and make it acceptable for everybody. And we've been working with all parties, and we have more time into this bill than I've ever had in a bill or any piece of legislation in this building. So, but I think it's something very crucial, and it's something that's very important to us as a state and working with our federal government when they put sanctions on a country that we're there to help support them in what they're doing. So,
thank you. I understand the problem about time-eating bills. The ones that you never expect to take the time end up taking all of it. Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Salvaggio.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. Not to restate my testimony from House Bill 3333, which is a substantially similar issue, what Representative Widener said is accurate. The treasurer and the treasury staff are working very closely with all the stakeholders associated with the with House Bill 3636 to develop a bill that both has no fiscal and is also fits in without fits into the investment plans of Treasury and the Investment Council without without impeding our performance. We feel that we're very, very close to reaching an agreement that works for everyone involved. As the representative noted, we're working currently on getting the fiscal down to zero. What that entails is making sure the information that we're working off of is information that's already available, that's already out there from the federal government, and right now we're just simply untangling exactly what that's going to look like compared to what we could interpolate if we did have a large fiscal and a large monitoring budget for this project. So it's going to be pared down some from the original version of House Bill 3636, but we do expect to get that fiscal knocked off. We have a couple of versions that that we're working through right now that I do believe will be acceptable once we get all these issues sorted out.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes, Representative Berger.
Just a comment. Gentlemen, I appreciate that at this late date we are, you know, this is tough stuff. Mr. Salvaggio, I know you're very aware of the fiduciary responsibility of the Treasurer's Office, and then we also add to it the need for no fiscal on this bill. I appreciate the work that you've both gone to get us here, and would encourage you to act decisively and resolve these issues in a way that satisfies both the needs. And thank you for bringing us this update, and I'm sorry that we aren't quite there yet.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on House Bill 3666? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3666 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3058. Chris. We're going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3058 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2563.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, House Bill 2563, the -2 amendment, is a gut and stuff of the original. The measure still has a couple of issues that are being worked out. We don't have a fiscal impact statement for it yet, and the revenue impact statement is still indeterminate. The measure would essentially potentially limit the centrally assessed alternative energy system assessment to 60 cents per watt of the installed capacity, and this is likely to be a kind of a great reduction in the assessed value of these systems, so it could affect wind farms and other things, and that's not clear that was the intent of the measure to begin with, but that seems to be what it says. Furthermore, the main point of the measure is to extend the sunset for alternative energy system tax credit or tax property tax exemptions from 2012 to 2018. And this, as it is now, this exemption is meant for alternative energy systems that are supplementing electricity or other energy that's used on site by the entity that's claiming the exemption, and it's not meant for not meant for utilities or entities whose primary purpose was to provide or transport power, and this would the measure would generally keep that thrust, and it excludes any entity now that is centrally assessed, whereas before it would exclude only people's utility districts and public utilities or any business whose primary purpose was the production of energy. But now the Statute 2 amendment changes the language to exclude any business that's centrally assessed. So there might be some issues with the drafting.
Yes, I suspect
that's
so.
That's called legislative understatement.
Yeah, Thank you. I would note that we're not really focusing on the original bill, which has a completely different intent than the Dash 2 amendment, but we are focusing on the subject of the Dash 2 amendment for the purpose of this hearing. We have three people signed up for today, Glenn Montgomery, Christina Skellinger, and Richard Steinberg. Could you come forward? Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, the nonprofit trade association that represents solar manufacturers, residential and commercial installers, utilities, unions, and any other organizations that are advocating for the solar industry. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2563. Although the language, I think there are some issues that we're still trying to work out. Admittedly, we've made a good faith effort in trying to advocate for a continuation of this property tax exemption and to clarify some of the language and solve some of the problems that currently exist today. One of the main problems that we have, besides the fact that it will sunset next year and we've got a number of municipal projects in which investors are sitting on the sidelines waiting to hear whether or not we're going to extend that property tax exemption, they're not going to invest in those projects until they have that answer, because that's part of the economic model that they're using to calculate what their return can be for that investment. But besides the sunset, the other snag that we have, about a year ago, there was an interpretation by the Department of Revenue regarding this property tax exemption for third-party financed systems. The Department of Revenue said that those projects would be subject to property tax. And that became a problem for any nonprofit, any church, any public building, most of which require a third-party investor to finance their projects. And the irony is they're not taxable entities, but that project would be considered a taxable project. So that changed, again, the economic model in which the projects were typically moving forward on. And it has stalled a number of projects. There's one in Klamath Falls. There's one in Lincoln City. There's one in Bend. There's one in Portland. And I think I may be missing one. But the fact of the matter is we've got a number of municipal projects where investors are folding their arms and waiting for an answer. And so we've tried to put language in this bill that says regardless of the method of financing, all of these types of alternative energy devices are not subject to property tax. So regardless of whether it's a third-party finance system or it's an owned system, that they would enjoy the property tax exemption. Now, where we get into the sticky wicket is the last paragraph that talks about the 60 cents per watt on centrally assessed properties. And that, in fact, I think we know that that's half-baked. We put a stake in the ground and tried to do our best to create some language there and provide some means of initiating that conversation. I think we do need to bring the Department of Revenue in there. They were not privy to that paragraph. I just was made known of that this morning. And Legislative Council needs to look at it and see how it interacts with the constitutional Measure 50 on how you assess properties once they come out of exemption. So we're aware of those issues, and we're certainly willing to work with you to hammer them out. And I did submit testimony. I submitted written testimony from one of my members, Solar City, which is a residential, primarily a residential installer that does installations throughout the nation. And most recently, we were able to change administrative rules that allowed leased systems in a residential environment to enjoy the residential energy tax credit. And Solar City submitted testimony, which includes a table on page 3 that basically spells out, here's what a property would look like, here's what a project would look like with and without a tax assessment. And you will notice that with that tax assessment, and I think they used a 1.2% figure for taxing the system, in the first year nearly doubles the cost of the project. It's not, in the grand scheme of things, not a significant outlay or opportunity cost for the local municipality, given the fact that they are going to stimulate some economic activity in their region. However, it's the difference between making any profit and not for the project. So those numbers are quite telling, and I think a good example of why this property tax exemption is so vital for at least the solar projects that we are speaking of today. And so with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'd like to defer my time to our others who are testifying.
Please. Yeah.
Thank you.
Chair Berger, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Christina Skellinger, and I'm from Girding Eadlin. We've been the past 4 years predominantly a real estate developer, and about 3 years ago.
Excuse me, if you would move the mic just a few inches further away from yourself,
okay.
It won't distort quite so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is this better?
That's
better. Okay. About 3 years ago, we got into the solar development business, and we've been working sort of across the United States on different projects and have completed a few locally. So what we do is we bring together financing and projects. So we've worked with school districts, community colleges, et cetera, who can't take advantage of the federal and sometimes state tax advantages. And we install solar. The investor owns the system, takes advantage of those tax credits, and then the school district or whomever we're working with benefits from some savings, either a roof lease or free electricity. And then eventually, at some point, the system reverts to that public entity. We've completed a number of projects. We've worked with Portland Community College, Portland Public Schools. Those projects were completed in 2009. We're currently working with Gladstone School District, Beaverton School District, and Grants Pass School District. I submitted written testimony from Gladstone. They couldn't be here today, and Beaverton School District is represented today. I wanted to, from the developer's perspective, these projects are, the property tax exemption in the amendment is incredibly important. I just found out this morning, it was my understanding that the language was fully baked and we had been working with DOR. Sorry to hear that it is not. However, the premise still stands that, this tax exemption or this exemption, this amendment, is actually really just a fix outside of the 60 cents. In 2007, there was actually an amendment to the statute, and that amendment, the intent of that amendment was to do just what we're doing now, which is to allow third-party projects, third-party investment projects, to be property tax exempt, and it was for a period of time until that interpretation was changed. So this is simply a fix other than that last paragraph with that 60 cents. Just so you understand the economics from our perspective, we're using with Beaverton, Gladstone, and Grants Pass, we're using the feed-in tariff program. And that, the economics, we ran some numbers. It's the difference between a 9% return for the investor, which is marginal, in this industry, to down to a 6%. So it's huge. It more than doubles the operating expenses and accounts for a fifth of the operating income. So it really turns these projects upside down. I don't know what would happen to the projects that are already in place, assuming that the property tax exemption extended to these projects. Now that they don't, I don't know what the impact will be to Portland Public Schools, Portland Community Colleges, and other projects that have been completed. I know that our projects for Beaverton, Gladstone, and Grants Pass will not move forward, and that's problematic because with the feed-in tariff, you have a deadline. Our deadline is October 15th of this year, so it is important. I know we're time-constrained here. I know it's the end of the session, but it is important that we do move this forward this year in order to get these projects done. And again, we're not the only ones that have these projects. So with that, I'll defer to Beaverton School District.
That's right. One's probably enough.
Yeah.
good morning. I'm Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart. My name is Dick Steinbrugge. I'm the Executive Administrator for Facilities for the Beaverton School District, and I'm here this morning to speak in support of this bill, and I can't really address the technical tax parts of it, but I did want to share with you what we perceive to be the benefit of this legislation to Beaverton and, frankly, our partner, Gladstone School District, who couldn't be here today. You have, I think, in the record a letter signed by Beaverton, Gladstone, and Portland Public. All three of the school districts strongly support this legislation. You also have my written testimony, which I won't read, but just try to summarize. I know that it's very late in the session, and we really do appreciate the opportunity that you've given us to include this before the legislative session is over, and I know it's difficult with time running out. We have been working, as Christina mentioned, for a couple of years to try to take advantage of the feed-in tariff legislation passed by the legislature a couple of years ago because, frankly, solar does need, in order to be economically viable, from my experience, solar does need to have some federal and state tax support benefits in order to be viable investment. School districts, as you know, right now are not say the least, swimming in extra money for to find the capital investment for these kinds of projects. And we're depending upon the private investor that Christina mentioned in order to bring the capital to the table to fund the projects. For us, for Gladstone and Beaverton, that's about $3 million, as I understand it, of capital. The projects would be on three of our school buildings in each district, six altogether. We would benefit by having essentially free solar power that's generated by those panels for 15 years. We estimate that's worth about 300,000 kilowatt hours of electricity per year, which isn't enormous, but it's important. It will save us a little bit of money. It's an opportunity to get renewable power in the school districts. We're also, by the way, looking at opportunities to use this information in classrooms. We've set up a strategy working with our teachers and so forth of how we can take the technical information that comes out of the system and apply it in classroom teaching applications to teach to specific learning targets, whether they're in math or science or perhaps even in social studies. So we see some great synergy here in terms of meeting some internal goals to push our energy conservation program forward, state goals in terms of more renewable energy, but also partnering with our teaching and learning folks within the school district in order to enrich the classroom environment. And so we see that as a win-win. We understand from our investor, as Christina said, that the economics for them of the project don't pan out without this tax exemption, so we very much hope and request your support for the amendment, even if the language needs to be cleaned up technically in this session, because our deadline for using the feed-in tariff allocation does expire in October, so it does need to happen this session, we think. Thank you very much. I would be happy to address any questions you might have.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gellinger, I'm curious, given that Girding-Edlin does a number of retrofits and work around building sustainable buildings, mm-hmm. Would investments other than solar, such as, or do you happen to know, such as a boiler retrofit or something that was more integral to the structure of the building, mm-hmm. Be tax exempt already? Maybe that's a question for staff.
That might be a question for staff. I'm not sure. I mean, we do a number of retrofits, and I'm not sure that we've looked into that. I don't know for retrofitting and removing one boiler and replacing it with another. I don't believe that's the case because we're not increasing the value of the property by replacing an existing equipment. But I'm not sure.
Representative Bailey, I believe that this property tax exemption only applies to alternative energy systems, so it would have to be solar, geothermal, wind, water, fuel cell, or methane.
Paul, Mr.
Yeah, please.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is not so much this particular bill, but the concept that if we are looking at the overall energy use within a building, and if we are trying to think about what the best energy management regime is for that building, whether that's an energy efficiency upgrade, whether that's a boiler upgrade, or whether it's the installation of a self-financed or privately financed solar installation on that building. It's all part and parcel of creating an efficiently managed, sustainable building. And regardless of who ends up financing that, whether that's a third-party entity or the district itself and what it does to the property value, we ought to treat all of that the same. And I think this bill is an important step in getting there.
Thank you. Other questions? I have a couple of issues that actually didn't come up until I was listening to your testimony this morning. One of them is very much related, actually, to Representative Bailey's question, and it may depend on the way in which the power is actually handled. But if a government agency or a nonprofit engages in a business that's unrelated to their primary purpose, and that's a business that would normally be subject to taxation, a non-exempt business, then normally speaking, they would that business would be subject to tax, property taxes, income taxes, and other kinds of taxes, even though it was owned completely by a nonprofit. Has anybody thought about the issue? Have any of you thought about the issue of unrelated business income or business activity that might result in taxation?
Chair Barnhart,
in this issue, in dealing with the fact that we're talking about putting a solar array on a roof, public building, and it's not really their business to generate electricity. It's their business to educate kids or provide some other government service.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm not a tax accountant, so anything I say can and will be held against me.
Yeah, right.
However, you know, in most the case where this may arise, the taxation is with the feed-in tariff program. Even so, we're using a net metering agreement, but there is the potential for the recipient of the volumetric incentive rate, the premium rate that's being paid out for that feed-in tariff, to be taxable. That residents and commercial enterprises that are engaged in that feed-in tariff have already been apprised of the fact that that's probably going to be a taxable revenue. I can't speak to a nonprofit or a public entity that is a non-taxpaying entity as to how that will play out in terms of unrelated business income. I'm not sure what that entails.
I think I can speak a little bit to that. So we have the school district, for example, they're actually not going to own the system. So the investor owns the system. So they aren't going to be taxed. They're not going to be taxed because they don't own it. They're not receiving any revenue. The investor will be taxed from the income of the property, so they will be taxed there. But in terms of the school district, they don't own it, so they're literally leasing the roof space as if they were leasing their roof space for a cell phone tower, something similar of that nature. So it wouldn't impact the schools or any other nonprofit whose primary business is schools. Their primary business is still schools, and they have no business in solar at this point until they own the system.
Aren't the lease proceeds themselves unrelated business income?
They're actually, the way that the feed-in tariff works, they're actually receiving free electricity for a period of time. And so it's not in the form of a lease. It's actually just free electricity.
Co-Chair Barnhart, maybe I could just add to that, and I'm not a tax expert either, so I'm not going to speak to that part of it. But the way the benefit works for the school district is that the kilowatt hours of power that are generated by the PV system go into the building. So in essence, we are using electricity generated from the solar panels on our roof instead of buying power from PGE. So when the power being generated is more than the building is consuming, which might happen during the summer, for example, when you have the most solar and less use in the building, goes back into the grid, and that's not part of our deal. Then that's between the investor and, in our case, PGE. So the benefit we only get would be from the kilowatt hours that go into our building that are produced by the solar, which is an offset. Therefore, we don't pay PGE for those kilowatt hours, if that helps.
Okay. The business entity that owns the solar array would be subject to income taxes, even if this bill were to be passed, on the income generated by the the project, according to the normal rules, whatever those are. Okay. All right. Other questions? Department of Revenue, do you want to be heard this morning?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. And just briefly, we're neutral on this bill, on the Dash 2 amendment. And we were contacted many months ago by David Vanthoff to talk about the concept in this bill. We worked with him. We even incurred expenses bringing the Department of Justice in to, as a resource to help craft some language. We provided that to them, and this is not the same language. So this is kind of new to me. We have some concerns. Christina kind of outlined some of those concerns already. So we'd be happy to continue to work with anybody on the concept.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, John, I have some questions about the wording here, and a little worried we're stepping into the whole centrally assessed with, you know, big waiters instead of just a strategic piece. But do you understand what we're trying to get to here? In terms of these arrays on roofs and on nonprofits and what we're trying to do, because time is very short, and I guess I would like to encourage the parties and DOR to get together very, very quickly to arrive at language that I can understand to get here.
Co-chair, we thought we'd done our part on that and provided the language, but a little surprised by this. So
this is not the language that you thought. Okay,
no,
well,
ma'am,
maybe
co-chair.
You could provide the proponents with that language and
we'd
sit down very quickly.
We'd be happy to meet instantaneously with anyone.
Good idea.
So
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, at this late date, Co-chair Berger's absolutely right. At this late date, we have to keep it simple. And if you already have language that you're pretty sure will work, we need to get moving on it. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 2563? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2563 and open a public hearing on reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3058. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3058 deals with the minimum tax for agricultural co-ops. You initially heard the bill back in February, and you have all of the paperwork related to the bill. You have a minimal fiscal impact. You have a revenue impact of about $1.5 million per biennium, and this is all pertaining to the Dash 3 amendment, which does replace the bill. There were two changes in the bill. One pertaining to the definition of Oregon's...
Oh, just a moment. It replaces the bill?
Yes.
It effectively replaces the bill. The bill, there are two changes, two sections of bold language in the bill. One that...
Oh, right.
Redefined
we're replacing the bold language. Thank you.
Right. It does it in a little bit different way
right.
from conventional means. So it redefines the definition for Oregon sales for agricultural co-ops. And then in the drafted bill, there's language on page 2 that would set the minimum tax to $150 for all of these co-ops, and that is deleted because that would override the other definition.
Good morning, Representative Hunt.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. This, as Chris said, this... has really come up over the last couple of years, although it really the problem is actually rooted in the original definition of single sales as we pass it, those few of us who were here in 2003, because that definition unfortunately ended up sweeping in those who do business through these co-ops. It really only that definition, the problem is rooted in that definition, although the application of that definition became broader after 2009. This will fix the portion of that that basically that currently results in double taxation of these folks who are growing wheat, for instance, and then using an Oregon-based co-op and then selling. Ironically, most of their sales are out of state or out of country. Right now, they have two steps in their process that take place here, and so they are unfortunately being taxed twice under the application of the single sales methodology. So this change, the bill, even the original bill, would have fixed that by exempting the definition of Oregon sales. You'll notice the difference now applies it to Section 1381 of the IRS code instead of applying it, as the original bill did, to state ORS Chapter 62, so that the sense from the wheat growers and the co-ops, who you may have already heard from or you will hear from, is that the DAS 3 amendments address the bulk of their concern, does so in a way that has the minimal possible revenue impact, as Chris said, about $1.4 million per biennium going forward. And we'll really continue to maintain, as I described, I think, at the first hearing, if you're a large manufacturing company in Oregon and you export most of your products to other places, you don't incur any tax. You just sell directly. You don't. If you're Nike or Intel, you don't go through a co-op. You just sell directly to an international customer, and don't incur taxes on your non-Oregon sales. Unfortunately, these wheat growers and some other agricultural folks who go through Oregon co-ops get stuck under the way the current Oregon sales definition is done, and this will fix that to their benefit and continue to maintain good competitiveness, especially for these growers who are operating on such a very narrow margin.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Hunt? I would simply note, in addition to what you've already said, that it is a competitive issue when you're selling internationally, and if you pay a tax, even a small one, it adds to your costs in a way that might get you to lose out to Australia or somebody else. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you.
Mr. McCulley, Mr. Buck, Ms. Jarvis. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley, representing the Agriculture Cooperative Council of Oregon. We are here today to speak in favor of House Bill 3058 and the Dash 3 amendments that Representative Hunt has presented to you. I first want to say that we appreciate all of the work that Representative Hunt has done on this issue. I think that we have finally reached a place where we can address the problem that was unintentionally created under the passage of the corporate minimum tax. I'm handing out kind of a redo of my testimony that I presented in February, would be happy to answer any questions you have. I would note that the Dash 3 amendments do address some of the questions raised by this committee during that initial hearing. Questions were raised about the scope of the bill, the application. We did narrow it in the Dash 3 amendments to just agricultural cooperatives. There was also a question about how the minimum tax applies to non-member co-op sales, and that is addressed in the Dash 3 amendment as well, saying that those sales to non-members would be treated as any other corporate sale. So those would be taxed under the corporate minimum. I think we have addressed the issues raised by the committee and encouraged the committee to move the bill forward.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, there again, I'm here for support for Mr. McCulley. If there are any specific tax questions, I believe
and,
at the last...
for the record, your name is...
I'm sorry. My name's David Buck. There again, we spoke about some of those questions earlier, and if there are any remaining questions regarding maybe some of the tax issues involving these changes, I'm here to answer those questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Wheat Growers League. And this was an issue that my members had brought up to Representative Hunt some time ago. I did want to echo Mr. McCauley's comments of appreciation for Representative Hunt's efforts on our behalf. We have been participatory in the Dash 3 amendments in the language in that. We're supportive of that, and we would ask for your support of this bill today as well. So I'm happy to answer any questions if you like.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one technical question. On the Dash 3 amendments, does that adequately address the double taxation or inclusion in the sales factor patronage dividends? They were specifically outlined in the original, and I want to make sure that it adequately addressed your issues with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vera Brewer, yes, they do.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? Comments? I guess not. Thank you very much. Sure. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning during the public hearing on House Bill 3058? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3058 and open a work session on House Bill 3058. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3058.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3058. Discussion? Yes, Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. happy to be voting on this bill today. Anytime you create a brand new tax, which is what we had, there's bound to be unintended consequences, particularly when it's a little bit rushed and there's a lot of controversy. So I'm happy to be able to take this vote and help out the cooperatives, which are critical to our agricultural businesses. I am concerned, though, and I want to express this for the record, that, you know, here again, we're talking about the right principles, low-margin businesses, businesses in the traded sector, businesses that create good jobs. And I'm happy to lend my support for the agriculture community, but it's high time that we take a look at the manufacturing and other businesses in this state that are being greatly harmed by this tax on gross receipts. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? I don't see any. Are there any objections to the motion, which is to adopt the Dash 3 amendments? Don't see any. Motion carries. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3058 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 3058 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Don't see any. Those who aren't here are excused. The motion carries. Representative Hunt, would you like to carry this bill? Representative Hunt will carry. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3058. Colleagues, we'll stand at ease for just a moment. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3678. And there she is. Representative
right
Powell. We'll come forward, explain the bill, and please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the new Oregon Workers' Compensation fee schedule provides an 80% reimbursement rate for ambulance service charges. And the ORS 724-525 ties the reimbursement rate for personal injury protection benefits to the workers' compensation fee schedule. What this bill does is it decouples ambulance service billings for personal injury protection benefits from the workers' compensation fee schedule. And it means that the ambulance service charges for personal injury protection will be paid as billed.
Representative Cowan, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, I am Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10. And I apologize for having too tight a schedule today, so breathlessly I have raced down here. There are a number of people here in the room who can explain the details of this bill to you, and I will leave it to them. But this came about, I don't actually think that too many bills qualify as a late session priority bill. To me, that has to be an unusual circumstance. And when they came and described the ramifications for local ambulance service providers because of some new changes in the workers' compensation rate and the 80% billing opportunity, you know, changes that were huge for that reduction from the cost of providing the service for the ambulance companies. And particularly the rural companies, although I think that it applies, I know that it applies across the board, and certainly that kind of a sudden reduction of 20% of your ability to recover the costs for providing a service is an impact for all of our ambulance companies. And I think that the key component of this whole question is when providers have a change in what their compensation is going to be, they have an opportunity to make decisions about whether or not they're going to provide the service to an individual. If you want to go to your doctor, they decide that they aren't going to take a certain group of patients, they can make that decision. But when an ambulance rolls to the scene of an accident, they don't have a choice. They need to provide the service to whomever they find. And when it's tied to personal injury protection on your automobile insurance, let's face it, a very large percentage of the ambulance runs are to motor vehicle accidents. And so consequently, it has a disproportionate impact on ambulance providers. And for that reason, I thought that it qualified as something that I considered an important enough issue to bring to us even in these closing days of the session, and I very much appreciate you hearing it, although I know the time is tight. So with that, I would like to turn it over to the folks who can actually speak knowledgeably on this subject, and unless anyone has any specific questions for me.
Thank you. Questions? We do understand that there's been an issue involving the effective date. And we've been talking about the possibility that if the bill goes to the floor today, the effective date might be amended to deal with that problem in the Senate. Would you see any difficulties with supporting that kind of an approach?
I don't see any difficulties. If those behind me I'm sure that they will share them with
sure.
you.
Sure, and I'm anticipating testimony, obviously, but since okay. I have you now, I need to ask the question.
No, and I will be happy to stay at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Let's hear from, I'm going to have trouble with this. It looks like Mark Stevens and Will Bauscher. Am I close?
You're very close.
Oh, good.
Co-Chair Barnhart,
Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Will Bowser. I'm here representing the EMS section of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. My full-time job is the EMS chief for the City of Corvallis Fire Department, and our service provides ambulance transport services for 763 square miles of the Mid-Valley, Benton County, Linn County, a small portion of Polk and Lane counties. The fire service really deploys the majority of emergency medical responders, both paid and volunteer, and we cover a range of geographic areas from urban areas in the Portland metro area to all the way out to Silver Lake and Burns and very remote portions of our state. And these services are heavily dependent upon ambulance reimbursement rates. And in fact, these rates not only support the transport portion of our EMS system, but in many cases also supports a lot of the first response through the resupply, training, and other supports for these small rural communities. For example, in our own area in Benton County, our agency actually resupplies most of the disposable supplies to all of our remaining eight first response agencies. The removal of the ambulance services from the PIP schedule would simply be a measure of offsetting other reimbursement issues that the ambulance industry has dealt with over the last many years through Medicare, Medicaid, and other reimbursement issues. For my own agency, the impact alone simply makes that impact kind of zero. In essence, for example, the mileage reimbursement that the Medicare Medicaid rates implemented in January has approximately the same impact as this would from an 80% perspective. So simply removing that would kind of maintain status quo for the majority of us in the Valley. With that, I'll kind of conclude my remarks and answer any questions and turn it over to my colleague here, Mark Stevens.
Chairman Barnhart and Chairman Berger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Stevens. I'm the president of the EMS section of the Oregon Fire Chiefs and division chief for EMS at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue in Washington and Clackamas counties. To add to Will's concerns for our folks, we represent the public agencies, city and fire, and when the transport not only affects the ambulance services in the public sector, but the revenues from the ambulance funds the first response as well. So when there's cuts in one end, it affects the first out EMTs and first responder companies and their equipment and their capabilities. Our volunteer and frontier areas would be especially hard hit. They're literally doing bake sales to buy equipment currently, and a cut such as this could put them in profound financial problems. And it affects us statewide. You will hear from the larger providers as well. Beyond just the fire department, first response and ambulance effects, it all comes from the same city and district budgets. So those local governments would have to address where to come up with that monies as well and who else would suffer and the downstream effects. So entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? We have several more people to go.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And now we're getting to the challenging part for me. It looks like Joanna Campy, Mannheim, and Randy, maybe Lancer, perhaps?
Lauer.
Oh, that's a U. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association, in strong support of House Bill 3678. And we want to thank Representative Cowan for her leadership in using a priority bill. And she does not give herself enough credit for knowing EMS. She actually, I didn't realize until we talked about this issue, that she worked as an emergency medical technician in Eastern Oregon and did training throughout Eastern Oregon. With me today are two of our members, Joanna Campy, who is Chief of Emergency Medical Services for Eugene Springfield Fire Department, and they also do billing services for a number of small rural providers, so she can address that aspect. And Randy Lauer is General Manager of American Medical Response Northwest, the 911 provider in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Josephine counties. I just want to give a little background on why we're here today. In 2003, when the legislature enacted an increase in personal injury protection benefits, there was a work group, and I, in fact, was part of that work group in 2003, and it was decided to link PIP benefits to the workers' compensation fee schedule. In retrospect, obviously, I wish that we had, at the time, said ambulance should not be part of that. But there had never been any fee schedule, workers' compensation fee schedule, for PIP benefits at that time. On April 1st, the new rule went into effect, setting workers' compensation benefits for medical services to injured workers for ambulance services at 80%, and that automatically then became the amount for PIP benefit reimbursement for medical services, ambulance services to injured automobile accident victims. As Representative Collins said, ambulance services are limited in how they can compensate for this kind of reduction. Number one, they cannot control their patient mix. They cannot say, well, we can't see quite so many motor vehicle accident victims. They cannot compensate that way. And number two, they cannot unilaterally increase their rates. Their rates are set by the governing bodies of the cities and counties which designate them as the 911 ambulance service provider. This has happened at a difficult time for ambulance service throughout the state, and we would appreciate your support of this bill. We'd be happy to answer any questions, and we thank you for hearing it today. And with that, I'll have Joanna speak. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Berger, I'm Joanna Campy, EMS Chief for the cities of Eugene and the city of Springfield. We provide ambulance service to those areas. The city of Springfield also contracts with several providers to provide ambulance billing for 21 agencies throughout the state of Oregon. In looking at the effects of this, for Eugene and Springfield alone, it's estimated that this will be approximately $165,000 that we will see a reduction of revenue in our budget this year. And in when we look at some of the smaller areas, it equates to 8% of their transports in Hermiston and 16% of their transports in St. Paul. So you can see that the effect for the smaller communities is much larger. Ambulance services throughout the state operate on a very, very thin margin. And in Huntington, Oregon, the ambulance service closed as a result of loss of revenue. And currently, Milton Freewater is in trouble, struggling, and is receiving funding from the county to supplement their budget to stay in service. Ambulance services are just struggling to stay, just to stay in service to our community. And our rural area in the state of Oregon is large, and we all travel to those areas, and we need those ambulances to stay in service to take care of people. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Mr. Lauer.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee, thank you. As Nan mentioned, I'm Randy Lauer. I'm the general manager for American Medical Response in Oregon. We are the 911 provider in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Josephine counties. So we have the, the honor of serving some of the most dense urban part of Oregon and some of the very rural part of Oregon. In those three counties, we respond to approximately 8,000 motor vehicle accidents every year. And I'll try not to repeat what you've already heard out of respect for your time and appreciation for your willingness to hear this matter at this late hour. But I'd be willing to answer any questions that you have, the impact that's already been discussed will affect all of the counties in Oregon, and we're no different in that regard.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Wand.
Just a brief comment. I'm glad that AMR is here. I want to thank you. For over a decade now, AMR has had a lifeguard service at the Glen Auto Park in Troutdale, Oregon, and during that time, we have not had a single drowning at that location. when one of the lifeguards has been there since the program started. It's a tremendous benefit to my community, and I just wanted to appreciate you on the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Berger.
Yeah, Nan, this work group that tied the PIP and the workers' comp, you were on it? And this was a cost savings. What were you trying to, and it was just an oversight that nobody realized what this would do to ambulance compensation? Do you want to go a little deeper into that, please, Nan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you know, it's frankly hard for me to remember when, actually it was somebody from Eugene Springfield who first called me a few weeks after the new workers' comp rule went into effect and said, you know, we're getting 80% compensation from auto insurers, and I couldn't even remember. So what it was all about, and frankly, I think that it was about keeping costs down, and I do remember discussing with members of the Ambulance Association, but we were not terribly concerned because there never had been any fee schedule. It didn't seem likely that there would be because ambulance service to injured workers is such a small part of workers' compensation expenses. So that's about all I remember. I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Powell's up next. He may have better insight into that.
He might. That's right.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? I thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony very much. And I would simply note that I'm very aware of the precarious financial situation that ambulance services are in the areas that I pay attention to in my district. And we need to make sure that we keep up with that and do what we can to make sure that they stay solvent. None of us ever know, ever, when we're going to need ambulance service right now, and it's got to be available. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Powell.
Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Mutual Insurance Companies. Appear before you not in opposition of this bill, nor do I know of any opposition to this bill. I would, in answer to Representative Berger's question, first of all, explain what PIP is. And many states, in fact, I think there are only 13 left that have a personal injury protection portion to their automobile insurance policies. And the reason some states have done away with it is it's become a very expensive portion of automobile insurance as medical costs have increased. Washington State, for example, it's an optional coverage. You don't have to carry it there. Here, it's a mandatory coverage. So everybody that buys an insurance policy for their automobile, even if it's just a liability policy and not covering the physical damage portion of the automobile, you must buy up to $15,000 worth of PIP coverage. And your automobile insurance policy is primary in the case of an accident and medical loss. It pays first. And then once the PIP benefit is depleted, if you are fortunate enough to be covered by health insurance, your health insurance takes over. So it is a first dollar coverage on a no-fault basis. It's part of the no-fault wave that was going across the country in auto insurance in the early 1970s. Why connect it to the workers' comp fee schedule? It was becoming very difficult for insurers to administer PIP because of the variance in provider billings. For the very same service, we were getting billings that were three, four times what other billings were. The courts got very testy when the only way to resolve an issue as to the billing's reasonableness would be to litigate it. And the courts did not like all these cases coming to them. And so one of the efforts that we undertook was to find a way to administratively resolve this. And the workers' comp fee schedule in Oregon
is not what's the proper term? It didn't save a lot of money. The fee schedule is fairly generous, and we knew that going in. But the administrative cost savings of knowing what the cost was going to be and not litigating the reasonableness factor is worth a lot of money. And the reason that's important to consumers is the less money that's expended out of this PIP category for any one service leaves more for additional services. So if you're severely injured in an accident, if any one provider is charging an astronomical amount for their service, it consumes all of the PIP benefit. And then the consumer is left, again, unless they have health insurance or if they have a high deductible health insurance, with a lot of out-of-pocket costs. So getting everybody to charge a reasonable amount of money for their service was very important. And the bill in 2003, we think, was good. We did have to adjust it in 2005 for the hospital side of the equation and satisfactorily reached an agreement with them and passed legislation doing that. So this is the second refinement. And as was testified earlier, at the time, the hospital, or we worked closely with the ambulance people, and they were very helpful in getting the legislation passed in 2003. And we did not expect them to be included in the workers' comp fee schedule. And while when I say that, I'm not blaming the workers' comp division for this issue, and I think this is probably the best resolution to that issue, and they can deal with their rulemaking separately from this issue. And so as you mentioned, Co-Chair Barnhart, we would appreciate a delayed effective date, giving insurers the time to switch over to the system that they had previously. It doesn't have to be a long one. If this bill is signed the 1st of July or though in that range, maybe an October 1 effective date, that would give August and September as a time lag for the insurers to comply with going back to the other system.
So a removal of the emergency clause would take care of that issue. Because of the 90,
Mr. Co-Chair, it would. However, I've talked to representatives from the Ambulance Association. If we just remove the emergency clause, it wouldn't go into effect until January 1 of 2012.
Thank you.
So I think they would prefer, and we are okay with an earlier.
So we change on passage date on line 20, on its passage to October 1.
Exactly.
And that takes care of it.
That would take care.
Okay. Thank you. That's a very useful. Representative Berger.
Thank you. John, I knew you'd have the answers here, and I appreciate the history here. Are there other exceptions that you anticipate here, or do you think we've reached the end of
Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger? I don't anticipate any.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was trying to put that as delicately as I could.
Yeah, the only other issue that I was wondering about is you indicated that the problem was that fees for PIP coverage tended to be quite variable. I guess that's the polite way of saying it.
Yes.
Did the workers' comp schedule that was adopted for these other issues actually deal with the variableness issue for the purpose of workers' comp? I mean, did they set a dollar fee, or do you know how they did that for these other areas? Or actually, maybe we can talk to Mr. Schultz about that issue.
That would be my preference.
Thank you. I suddenly realized I'm way past your area, aren't I? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while we have you here, maybe you could share with us the cost very generally that PIP, mandatory PIP coverage adds to our policy premiums, very generally.
Yeah. Co-chairs and Representative Benz, I don't know why I cannot bring that, because I just renewed my auto insurance policy and I did look through that.
And I guess the best thing for me to do is get back to you with that.
Yes, please.
Right. My purpose in asking is just to see how much of an increase in that portion of the premium we might see as a result of this modest change.
Co-chairs and Representative Bentz, I think the change would be minimal. I don't think it would be a dramatic amount.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Does DCBS want to weigh in on this one? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of Department of Consumer and Business Services. To address your question previously, this was one of many types of charges that were paid as billed until we promulgated this rule, which took effect on April 1st. In the workers' compensation systems. And one of the reasons that we did that in this area and in the others was to try to control costs, because there was variance in billings. When it's part of a fee schedule, if you're paying as billed, essentially there's no ceiling on the fee at that point.
Representative Berger?
I'm just wondering, Mr. Schultz, about the timing of this. If this work group came up with this whole thing in 2003 and the rulemaking wasn't completed until April 1st of this year, that seems like a pretty long time. Any insight as to why that took so long?
Yes, Madam Chair. We revise our fee schedule annually. The fee schedule was already in place when the legislation was passed in 2003. We revise our fee schedule annually. We had never put, as been described before, we'd never put a ceiling on ambulance fees, as well as many other fees inside the fee schedule, until this year, when we held an external advisory committee meeting, as well as public rules hearing. And the advice that we received from our external advisory committee was to set a fee ceiling at 80% as charged, and so we implemented that recommendation this year.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
I'm confused, I think, with that response, because 80% of a very, very large number is still a very, very large number, if that's the concern. Can you give us some insight as to why 80% of a very large variable number would be the correct way of approaching this kind of issue?
Mr. Chair, I'll attempt to do that. There were a number of services provided within the workers' compensation setting where there was no ceiling or maximum fee that could be charged. It amounted to, within the workers' compensation system, about $28 million in charges a year. We had raised some fees. We were lowering some others in an attempt to try to ensure that our injured workforce has access to good medical care, but also so as not to burden employers with too high of workers' compensation charges. So we were seeking a balance in terms of increases and decreases. This was one area where we received input from our external advisory committee to set a new fee ceiling in several areas, including ambulance services. And it was an attempt to save about $4 million within the workers' compensation system in this one area. You're right, it's 80% of a fee is still a rather large number, and in most areas I think it's going to work fine. In this particular area, for the reasons that the people who have testified before me have already pointed out, where they don't get to pick and choose the people that they provide services to, they don't get to increase their fees immediately. It's a much longer negotiation process, as I understand it. This is something that's going to be difficult for them to try to balance within their own revenue issues. So this was one area that we did get feedback on after the rules were promulgated, that this was going to cause a problem.
Thank you.
And that was, you anticipated my next question, of course, because the testimony we've heard is that the ambulance services don't set their fees. They're set in negotiations with franchisors or by order from the agency heads that they work for, city councils and county commissions and so forth. Okay. Anything else for Mr. Schultz? Thank you very much. We do appreciate that explanation. It's very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on House Bill 3678? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3678 and open a work session on House Bill 3678. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, normally I'm hesitant to let a bill go out that isn't finished. In this case, the timing issue is one that is discussed, and I think that we can work closely with our Senate colleagues to get that resolved in the Senate, but the time is short, and I think this is an important bill for services, so I'm going to move House Bill 3678 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 3678 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the conversation and apologize that I had to step out for a moment. Recognize this is an important issue and would just want to put a little caveat for myself that I'm just kind of coming to it and don't feel fully up to speed yet, so I'm willing to support the motion, but I have some further work to do before I have a decision for myself on the floor.
Thank you. That's useful. Other discussion? With that caveat in mind from Representative Reed, is there any objection to the motion? No objection to the motion. Motion carries. Is there anyone absent? Yes, there is one. That person is excused. Representative Cowan? Representative Berger?
Yes, I would just respectfully ask Representative Cowan, when she carries this bill, to mention the timing issue so that it gets on the record of the floor.
That'd be helpful. Thank you. Representative Cowan will carry the bill. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3678. Paul, do we have any other business this morning? One comment to make, and maybe Representative Berger has one, too.
Go ahead. I was just going to ask who our student guests are.
Oh, well, that would be great.
South Eugene High School, AP, U.S. Government.
Hey, wonderful.
Welcome to the Revenue Committee.
Welcome to the Revenue Committee. My alma mater, 1964. I was in Mr. Goodnow's AP history class in 1963.
He's not teaching.
He is not teaching that anymore. I am not surprised. Thank you very much. Colleagues, be aware that we're on 1 hour notice or actually instant notice for work sessions. We have several bills that we might work on instant notice. We're contemplating the possibility of a meeting on Friday morning. We will keep you informed. But we're not scheduling it right now, but we'll keep you informed. Anything else? With that, committee's adjourned.